evening and welcome to the Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara. The world's attention is yet again on Iraq as Sunni militants progress towards Baghdad.
All of these problems in the Middle East, they arise out of this toxic mixture, in my view, of bad politics and bad religion.
We'll analyse the current crisis in depth with a panel of experts. First, we'll listen to the news read by Una O'Hagan.
Good evening. Carers groups are welcoming the government's move to reinstate some discretionary medical cards. Around 15,000 people with an acute or lifelong medical condition who lost their discretionary medical card or GP visit card after an eligibility review between July 2011 and last month are to have them returned. The Taoiseach Enda Kenny said the cost of restoring the cards was €13 million. He also said he was sorry for families who were severely inconvenienced. Catherine Cox from the Carers Association said the government needed to do more than just return the cards.
We have met families who have had to pay out up to €1,200 per month on their medication when they lost their card. So what we're saying is now government need to reimburse those families as well as reinstating their medical cards.
Residents in the Iraqi city of Baghdad are stocking up with supplies as militant Islamists appear to be moving closer. Fighters from ISIS or ISIL and other armed groups briefly seized parts of the city of Bakuba, 60 kilometres away, before being pushed out by the security forces and Shiite militias. There are reports of a mass killing in Bakuba. More than 40 prisoners being held in a police station that came under attack were found dead. The former Anglo-Irish Bank Director of Finance, Willie McAteer, has been charged with taking part in an alleged €7.2 billion conspiracy to mislead the bank's investors about the true value of deposit books. Mr. McAteer of Greenrath, Tipperary Town, County Tipperary, is the fourth person to be accused of fraud by inflating deposits at Anglo. He was arrested today and brought before Dublin District Court, where he was remanded on bail. The United States says it has captured the man it describes as the mastermind of the attacks on the US consulate in Benghazi in Libya 4 years ago. Four US officials, including the US ambassador to Libya, were killed during the attacks on the 11th of September 2012. The Pentagon said Ahmed Abu Katala was captured in Benghazi on Sunday and would be brought to the US to face trial. And the weather forecast, dry tonight with clear spells, although mist and fog may form again. Mild and close, lowest temperatures 11 to 13 degrees in light breezes. That's all for now. There'll be news again at 11.
Thanks, Una. You're welcome to the Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara, standing in this evening for Audrey. Joining me in studio is Dr. Ali Salim, spokesperson for the Islamic Cultural Centre in Dublin, Dr. Vincent Jurak, lecturer in Middle East Politics in UCD, Hussam Sam Najer, a trained sniper. Sam is an Irish-Libyan revolutionary who became a battlefield commander of a unit of the National Liberation Army of Libya. And he also authored the book Soldier for a Summer. I'm also joined this evening by Dr. John O'Brennan, lecturer in European and International Politics at Inuai Maynooth, and also by Carol Hunt, journalist with the Sunday Independent and The Herald. You can contact the programme by text 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and follow us and interact on Twitter at latedebate.rte. The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant has progressed speedily towards Baghdad and in Iraq in recent days, taking Tikrit, Mosul and Tal Afar. Iraq's security forces look at times helpless, forcing the US to deploy a small backup force. We're going to analyse the current crisis this evening, why it has erupted now and why at this speed, and we'll ask if the international community will react and, if so, how. First of all, let's listen to former British Prime Minister Tony Blair on Sky News Sunday explaining why there is a crisis at the moment in the Middle East.
All of these problems in the Middle East, they arise out of this toxic mixture, in my view, of bad politics and bad religion. And what's happened is that these groups, these extremist groups, are able to operate, destabilize countries, and the majority of people, and by the way, this is the good news about the Middle East, the majority of people actually want to live in peace, but they're not being allowed to by these extremist groups. And the reason why, whether we like it or not, we're going to get involved in this ultimately is because these extremist groups also intend to target us.
And that's former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Dr. Vincent Jurak, is he right? Is it a complex mix of bad politics and bad religion?
Well, it's a complex mix of bad politics. I don't know what bad religion is, but if we're talking about bad politics, then I think Tony Blair should know all about it, because he's part of the bad politics that, in a sense, has triggered what we're seeing in Iraq.
He's saying it's not really, it's not nothing to do with the invasion in 2003, nothing to do with the surge in 2007 or 8. This is Iraq's own making.
Yeah, well, you know, to coin a phrase, he would say that, wouldn't he? It's an extraordinary claim to even begin to imagine that what's happening has nothing to do with 2003, or the surge for that matter. I mean, there are a number of ways in which there is a line from the invasion of Iraq in 2003 to what's happening at present.
And do you know what? Before we get into that, and we will get into that in depth over the next hour or so, maybe you could explain to us who is ISIS?
Well, ISIS, as you say, is the group known as the Islamic State in Iraq, and Asham or the Levant or what may loosely be termed Greater Syria. So it connotes more than the modern state of Syria. And in many respects, it is an inheritor group from the radical jihadist groups that emerged in Iraq in response to the invasion of 2003. So albeit that this is a group that has broken with, for instance, Al-Qaeda more fairly recently in terms of a dispute with Ayman al-Zawahiri, it is still an inheritor group, a successor group to Al-Qaeda in Iraq, to groups led by people like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. So in many respects, it flows from all of that.
So, John O'Brien, is it simply an anti-West group? Is that it?
Well, ISIS certainly has a globalist philosophy in the same sense that Al-Qaeda did. Its ambitions go beyond Syria and possibly beyond Iraq as well. And it represents, I suppose, an evolution, if you like, of the jihadist type or the jihadist kind of organization over a period of years.
That's interesting you say their ambitions go beyond Iraq or the region in which they're operating now. What are their ambitions?
Well, there's a vast range of literature that you can access online in visual form as well as in text. The kind of things that were being emphasized by Bin Laden in the 1990s and subsequently about the caliphate, for example, are things that come up again and again in this kind of literature. So, you know, the caliphate which disappeared, the Ottoman caliphate in 1924, is one that ISIS wants to see replace the nation states that exist currently in the Middle East.
And is ISIS, Vincent, cooperating with Al-Qaeda? Is it a subset of Al-Qaeda? What's the relationship with Al-Qaeda, if any?
Well, I mean, Al-Qaeda, in a sense, is an entity, if you like, the coherence of which is often exaggerated and misunderstood. In many respects, Al-Qaeda, I think, in today's world, is as much a sort of a repertoire of ideas, a particularly well, extreme as many would see it, even deviant interpretation of Islamic sources. In terms of the relationship between ISIS, so-called, and Al-Qaeda, as now led by Ayman al-Zawahiri, there has been a falling out. So at one point, there would have been a sense of affiliation with Al-Qaeda. But arising out of, and this partly relates to the point John made, arising out of conflicts between groups in Syria, because ISIS began to be very active in Syria. Conflicts in which Syrian groups essentially felt that ISIS were outsiders. Arising out of that dispute, there was a sort of adjudication, as it were, by Zawahiri, which led to a breach between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. But I do think it's important, and we should at some point move away from an exclusive focus on ISIS, because what's happening in Iraq is much, much larger than that.
OK, but I do want to touch on it, because just to give people a grounding. Ali Salim, when people have been analysing or examining what's been happening over the last number of weeks in Iraq, they hear of stories of rebels versus Syria, first of all, rebels versus Iraq. They hear of the antagonism and the violence between Sunni and Shia sects. Is this current crisis, is it political or is it religious?
Well, let me explain first that the issue between the Sunnis and the Shia initially started as a political question. As after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslims encountered a question that they did not have in his lifetime, i.e. who would be the Muslim successor? Well, the majority of Muslims said whoever is elected. Well, the very minority, they said, no, it has to be somebody having blood relation with the Prophet. Well, the majority had their say to go for the first ruler or for the first caliph. And the same thing happened for the second and the third. And then all the Muslims agreed on the fourth because he was elected and he had blood relation with the Prophet. And that was Ali ibn Abi Talib. After his death, the Muslims faced the same question because the Shias wants the leadership to be for his children and his grandchildren and so on. But the Muslims said no. The majority of Muslims said no, it has to be whoever is elected. And then over time, the Shias, they got divided among themselves by and large into three main groups, and two of them have developed over time issues that can be classified as serious dogmatic issues for Muslims in general, whether they're Sunnis or the Shias. But again, a factor that I have to mention here that we are not talking about half-half division or even two-thirds and one-third. You're talking about the Sunnis constituting more than 93-94%, and then the Shias constituting approximately 6 or 5% of the Muslim population.
So what you're telling me, though, is that what's being played out now between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers now in the Middle East, is a violent religious division that goes back thousands of years.
Well, not like this, but I have to say that the religion has been inserted in the issue, because what happened in Iraq under the leadership of Saddam, the Sunnis and the Shias coexisted, and people here in the West by mistake thought that Saddam represented a Sunni regime and excluded all the Shias. In actual fact, one-third of his cabinet was made of Shiites. Yeah. And the government institution, 40% places, was covered by Shias Iraqi, although the massive majority in Iraq in his time until today's time is represented by the Sunnis. But what happened is that the American and the British volunteered to get themselves involved in something which was entirely not of their business. And under the guise of chemical weapons, they decided to stab in Iraq, which was a clear breach to all international norms. I have to admit that this atrocity was committed within the hearing and the sight of the entire world. And everybody turned a blind eye because that crime was perpetrated by America and Britain. The West, that people talk about democracy and freedom and all of that, turned a blind eye to more than 500,000 of Iraqi children killed by the sanction imposed by America on Iraq. After the removal of Saddam and his regime, America...
Which was a violent regime.
It was an oppressive regime. But if you compare the situation during Saddam's time and the situation in today's time, or when the Americans were completely running the show over there, Saddam's regime could be classified then as paradise in this comparison. At least people managed to live and had there was security and peace. Yes, dictatorship, but there was. And currently, there is nothing whatsoever in Iraq. You see, like for every 8,000, one doctor migrated, and that is because no food over there.
Okay, people can text us 51551. Carol Hunt. This action by Sunni militants is a reaction to oppression by the Shia controlling minority in Iraq.
Well, yes, and that is what they are saying, and has been said. Of course, the problem does stem, the problem that we're seeing at the moment does stem from the 2003 intervention. The regime then could have been seen as a fairly secular regime. It was secular, certainly in comparison to what we see today, and it was not sectarian. So at the moment, what we're seeing really is a sectarian reaction to the Shia forces that were then put in place really by American and by British regimes. And now we're going to have to see what Iran does. Iran now, the West are looking to Iran to see, will they intervene? Are they going to support the Maliki regime? And hopefully they will stay out of it, but that remains to be seen.
Sam Najjar, what's your reading of the situation, of the current crisis as it's unfolding in Iraq?
It was funny actually looking through some of my old reports earlier on just for the show to see what my state of mind was back in 2012 when I was on the Syrian front lines and witnessing the atrocities for myself. In one report I did state that with the prolonging that of Western forces not getting involved in Syria and the porous borders being created and anyone and everyone stepping in with whatever ideology or agenda is going to cause a lot of trouble in the future, is going to cause some kind of reaction. And we see that we're witnessing that now. We see the reaction from the Sunni population within Iraq, which is, you know, obviously a tactical move by ISIS, you know, and as well as probably being pushed by the regime forces.
How so?
Well, if the regime forces are closing in on the Syrian cities, they had a path of manoeuvring tactically into Iraq with the Sunni population there, and with the obviously with the way the Sunni population are feeling towards them now, looking at them as their only hope. You know, a lot of the people there in Iraq that are fighting alongside ISIS probably would not like to be fighting along ISIS.
And you're agreeing with that, Vincent?
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about it. And you know, the notion that a group that comprises several thousand, no matter how battle-hardened they may be, can rapidly take over such an enormous territory in Iraq, unaided. And the idea in turn that they might be able to do it against the will of the local population is ludicrous. What you have here is a community that is marginalised, disenfranchised, that has been protesting since at least 2012. Those protests have been ignored or suppressed, as the case may be, by the al-Maliki government in Baghdad. And as Sam says, a lot of these people don't necessarily support ISIS in terms of its extreme objectives, but see it as preferable to an onslaught from the Iraqi army, see it as preferable to an Iraqi army that with whom they feel very little affiliation or loyalty.
So you're saying they're not a concerted force of extremist Sunni Muslims?
Well, ISIS certainly are, but I think what you're looking at, I mean, if you look at reports from Mosul, for instance, or if you look back 6 months ago to January of this year, when a similar, what one might call, mobilisation that included radical jihadists, but also very many others, what do you see comprising that mobilisation is radical Islamists, for want of a better term. This terminology is, of course, always uncomfortable anyway. Ba'athists, those who would have considered themselves part of a popular resistance, not necessarily Ba'athists, but resistance to the American invasion in 2003. And others, including many who characterise themselves in Sufi terms expressly to avoid the characterisation as Sunni jihadists.
But if they're not then, John O'Brien, if they're not a trained, structured army, if it's a ragbag of groupings coming together, how have they taken to Crete, Mosul and Tafar with such speed?
Well, one of the reasons is that they've been battle-hardened in Syria. That's absolutely clear. The second, I think, is money. They are enormously well-resourced. I mean, some estimates suggest that they have up to $1 billion in funds secured from benefactors in the Gulf, in Saudi and Qatar and elsewhere. And extraordinary events over the last few weeks. When they reached Mosul, for example, they were able to get into the central bank and get away with, some estimates suggest, almost $500 million. I mean, this is a very, very well-resourced organisation.
Resourced by whom? It's not just robbing banks, is it?
But if I can interject, ISIS also have significant control over at least parts of the Syrian oil industry, rudimentary as it now is, and trading in that brings in very, very substantial revenues and has done for months, if not years. So that alone would bankroll a great deal of what we're seeing in terms of the core. And you know, I stress there is, of course, a battle-hardened core. But what I was pointing to earlier was a broad sympathy with the anti-Shia orientation of ISIS. that is not much more than my enemy's enemy is my friend for a lot of Iraqis.
But we shouldn't forget also that back in 2007-08, the Sunni population actually threw out al-Qaeda, where the government in Baghdad rather smartly through the Awakening Councils worked with the tribal leaders, and that was sufficient with the American surge as well to turn back that earlier wave of extremism. There's no reason that that won't happen again and can't happen again. But for that to happen, the politics in Baghdad in the region has got to be moderated and has got to be right.
Ali Salim, let me read you a quotation from Robert Fisk, an article of his recently. He says, does Saudi power both feed the monster in the deserts of Syria and Iraq and cozy up to the Western powers that protect it? Basically, he's asking the question, is Saudi Arabia duplicitous?
Well, I'd like to take Saudi Arabia out of this problem, because my reading to the situation is that the current regime under the leadership of Maliki has been weakened because of a number of reasons. Number one, they are a minority, and I would not classify them as a religious minority, but as a political minority. Now, we have seen leaders from the Shia community in Iraq allying with the ISIS and the Baathists over there. Now, we've seen Muqtada Sadr coming out and speaking publicly against Maliki and saying that, yes, this is a revolution. This coincided with the statement expressed by the International Union for Muslim Scholars, describing it as a revolution. I think that rapid progress and all of a sudden happening overnight is because Maliki's regime is weakened from inside. They have failed to gain support from their own people, like the Shia people. Now, they do not. Like, Muqtada Sadr is against him, and he has his big militias over there and a great number of supporters on one side. On the other side, now, the Baathist people, they were not terminated. The people over there, when Americans, they walked in Iraq or in Baghdad, not because of winning the war, but because of the Saddam was betrayed. You see, the Baathist people...
Let me, on that point and on previous points you've made, let me read you a text from one of our listeners. This listener says, unbelievable revisionism from that Ali Salim. There is no proof that sanctions were responsible for 500,000 Iraqi kids, as he said. What he is being allowed airbrush is that Saddam's Ba'ath Party killed 30,000 Iraqis every year for a decade before America liberated the country. Bottom line is that the dysfunctional, misogynistic, internecine Middle East is regressing and the rest of the civilized world is progressing.
Well, I have to congratulate him. I wouldn't be courageous enough to make this statement, to be honest with you, because if you compare the current situation, I'm not defending Saddam. I see Saddam as a dictator. But actually, if I have two evil people, I would say I would go with the less harmful evil than the other, and that is my philosophy.
You think Saddam Hussein was less harmful than what we have in Iraq?
Of course, definitely he was. You see, at least, well, Saddam Hussein would kill whoever came near his throne. But if you want to live in process, Saddam Hussein...
Are you saying Nouri al-Maliki is more evil than Saddam Hussein?
Of course.
Why?
Because with Maliki, you can't live in Iraq. But with Saddam, if you stayed away from his throne, you could have lived and prospered.
Can you not live in Iraq under Maliki simply because, that the majority don't agree with him, or that certain powerful sects don't agree with him?
No, because the Maliki is allying with the Shia in Iran. Now, the Shia in Iran, they have conflict with the Arab Shias in Iraq. So he doesn't have too many friends in Iraq. He is entirely dependent on his neighbours.
Do you agree with that, John O'Brien?
Well, I think the problem is that Maliki has decided that a militarist solution is the only solution that will prevail here. This is the real problem now in Iraq. And I think for that, you have to understand Maliki as a character. He grew up in a modest Shia home. He was from a dissident family during Saddam's reign. He spent 24 years in exile, deeply suspicious mindset. He seems to have come to a view at a certain point in time that cooperation with and reconciliation with the Sunni minority and with the Kurds just isn't worth it. And that
a military solution is the only solution. Would you agree with that, Sam?
I think that the lines should be redrawn, to be honest with you. You know, it's time for the old lines, the colonial lines, to be redrawn, obviously, to to be more sensitive to sectarian differences within the region. Maliki should go as part of any good gesture avoid war. If a war is not what we want to see, if there's not going to be a bloodbath, because it will be a bloodbath, especially from now we're just talking like Syria spilling into Iraq and the whole region, something we haven't witnessed before.
Yeah, can you outline to me, how do you think this will develop over the next couple of weeks?
I think it's hard to foresee how this one's going to develop, because it's different to all the other, to anything that we've witnessed in the Arab Spring. It's morphed into this sectarian, all-out geopolitical crisis, to be honest.
Has it at the moment? Are you saying that it's been covertly funded by neighbouring states?
Yes, everyone has an interest and everybody has a hand, and that's where the lines have become so blurred. It's the same in Syria. In Syria, again, looking through my old reports, I said in 2012, this is not an Al-Qaeda jihad, this is a people's revolution and we want to help. And that's what our mindset was in 2012. I couldn't say that now because the lines have become so blurred. Bashar has played the game a lot better than Gaddafi, has opened the doors to all these extremists that he's been screaming about from the beginning, and tarnished the whole revolution, and now it's pouring into Iraq. And to be honest, to foresee exactly how it's going to play out is hard, because we've never witnessed anything in history like this before.
So who do you think is covertly, overtly involved in this crisis?
Let's see. Francis Bacon, the philosopher, once said, "Never hit a dog with your hand, for the dog might retaliate at you. Always use a stick, and with that stick beat the dog, and then they'll never retaliate against you." So we have countries like Qatar, the Emirates, all these different countries fueling fires and flames. And everybody has an interest and everybody has a hand. And this is where the problem, you know, my reason for going to Syria was the people. And that was my agenda. And that will always be my agenda in those regions.
Carol Hunt.
I'm just surprised that the elephant in the room seems to be Saudi Arabia. I think a lot of people in 2003, when they saw Blair and Bush, you know, invade Iraq, were going, what the hell? Why Iraq? What have they ever done to anybody? Meanwhile, most of the bombers were from Saudi Arabia, where we know from the 1970s the particular sect of Wahhabism has been spreading. It's been spreading all across the Middle East. It's been spreading into Britain. It's been spreading into Europe. And it's been funded by Saudi Arabia. And nobody says it. And
explain what Wahhabism is.
Wahhabism is... we would call it like a medieval type sect of Islam, where they... only goes so far. It was a particular Islamic prophet who said that Islam should not be contaminated by, well, progress, Western culture, that it should stop at the time that the Quran was written. So we would look at it as particularly medieval. This is the type of sect that has been pushed through from Saudi Arabia.
So why do you call Saudi Arabia the elephant in the room?
Because nobody ever says it. We, you know, Saudi Arabia
says
is
what? Sorry,
that Saudi Arabia needs to be tackled, in that they have questions to answer, because
in this crisis
they have it? Well, in this crisis, in the whole Middle Eastern crisis, in the crisis since 2003, since the 70s, since the spread of extreme Islamicism, for want again of a better word.
Let me get this clarified. You think they have questions to answer because of their extreme form of Islam, is that right?
And because of their funding of extreme forms of Islam worldwide.
Ali Salim.
Well, I might a little bit disagree with you on that. I would say, like, I have been to Saudi Arabia quite a few times, and I totally disagree with the number of what you can describe as aspects of the social texture inside Saudi Arabia. And like, we have a lot of examples on that. The Wahhabism, through my reading, it was founded by Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab. And I see him as, like, he was a scholar in his thinking, you see. But the people who came after him, a number of people read his books, and some of them, they got it right, and the others got it wrong. However, the others who got it wrong, I think they only got it wrong because of the social texture in Saudi Arabia that generates their life in a particular fashion that appears to the Western as it is a version of Islam. No, it's actually a culture. Likewise, every other country has their own culture. I would say, well, if Saudi Arabia is involved in that, well, there's so many other countries who are involved in so many other issues.
What's your point, Carol Hunt, in relation to Wahhabism? Is it that it's extreme and it shouldn't be extreme and that that's contaminating other forms of Islam? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it is. I think not enough moderate Muslims have spoken out about it. I think it is contaminating.
I'm one of them.
Oh, good. Well, there we go. And yes, I think I would have huge disagreements with it on issues of human rights and different areas.
A number of people want to get in. I'll go to Sam first.
Can I just say, about moderate Islam, it's the same what we're witnessing now, for example, what I witnessed in Libya and in Egypt now. There's nobody that represents the masses politically or on any scale in either after the revolutions. You had a choice of either going with the more Islamist political groups are the very secular and liberal. And so there's no in-between moderate political entity or body to represent the masses. And that's why everything is becoming so polarised and you're seeing extremism flourish, because you're seeing a lot of Muslims saying to themselves, you know, oh, I feel like I'm betraying myself to if I go with a secular way of life, you know.
And Vincent Jurek, you wanted to get in on Saudi Arabia, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, with all due respect to Ali, I think simply talking of Wahhabi Islam in Saudi in cultural terms, which is valid up to a point, is only valid up to a point, because the issue on the broader regional or geopolitical level, and particularly in the context of events since 2011, but also much earlier, as Carol has said, is that without a shadow of a doubt, the leadership in Saudi, successive regimes in Saudi, have sought to export a particular version of Islam. And it's a puritanical, which may be fine and dandy depending on how you interpret Islamic sources, but it is also intolerant. I don't think there's any doubt of that. And in the current setting, it is an understanding of the politics, not the religion of the region, which constructs a Sunni-Shia division, which, of course, is now being brought to fruition by virtue of the fact that people have believed in this as an essential feature of the region when it wasn't necessarily, and have acted as if it was a feature of the region, and as a result are conjuring it into existence. And this is a play that works very well in the US, for instance, and elsewhere in the world, that there is this persistent and potentially, if not actually, violent division. The reality is that violence between Sunnis and Shias in the history of Islam is comparatively of very limited extent, and compare it, for instance, to the wars of religion and Christian tradition, it hasn't been a feature. But it is now something that is being read into the politics of the region and is embedded in the reactions of both regional and international actors.
Would you agree with that, John? For many years, peaceful coexistence between Shia and Sunni?
Sure. There is a very valid comparison, I think, to be made here with the Yugoslav collapse in the 90s, where when the different parties in Bosnia were in conflict in 1992, the argument that was being made on the airwaves in America and elsewhere was ancient hatreds, that these people have hated each other for centuries. This is a natural kind of progression of those earlier historical kind of trends. That wasn't true in the case of the Balkans, and as Vincent said, it isn't true here. But there is something, I think, that is equally as interesting in terms of Saudi Arabia, and that is the competition with Iran. In a sense, Iraq and Syria now are proxies, and the Sunni-Shia divide is a proxy for the competition and the tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia.
Which brings forth the question, what should be done? Should there be some kind of intervention? Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair on Sky News Sunday, let's go back to what he had to say. He explained what should be done in Iraq.
If you talk to British security people today, or the French, or the Germans, their single biggest anxiety about our own security in our own country today are returning jihadist fighters from Syria. So my point is, I understand entirely why people want to say, stay out of it, it's someone else's fight, it's got nothing to do with us. But unfortunately, the people we're dealing with, they are going to pull us into this whether we like it or not. Just now, that does not mean, and let me make this clear, I'm not suggesting we put ground troops in and we do a full-scale invasion as we did in Iraq or Afghanistan. But I am saying we are going to have to take an active role in trying to shape events in Syria and Iraq and indeed across the region.
And that's Tony Blair saying that we should, as in the West, should try and shape events in Iraq. What's your reaction to that, Ali Salim?
Why should the West shape something in a place that's not theirs? Why?
Because he says that it will bring for jihadists and attacks to the West.
No, because there is oil in this country. That's why they want to be involved in that. They say, like, if the international community acts on virtual basis, they should have acted in Syria ages ago. They should have acted in various parts of the world. But they will only act if there is economical issues.
He says he wants to avoid, and I didn't hear him say this, but I assume he wants to avoid another 9/11, another attack on Madrid, for example.
Well, who made it? Well, I tell you, see, what he's saying, I can't accept. Number one, I don't trust him. Number two, my philosophy that wherever there is equality, there is peace. The recipe for any confrontation is inequality. The oppression. If you invade a country, no matter you call it this tomb of the desert, whatever terms you invented to convince your soldiers to go and fight, see, people have minds and they can think and they understand. The tricks and the maneuvers he and Push played and portrayed in a wonderful frame and showed to the world, this is not accepted.
John?
I entirely agree with Ali. Blair may even have been right in some of the things that he was saying, but the point is he was entirely the wrong person to be carrying that message. He is so completely discredited because of the invasion in 2003.
Okay, but what did he say that was right then, in your opinion?
Well, he pointed to the danger of ISIS as an extremist organization, to the spread of militant ideology, to the kind of importation of that back into Britain and to other countries via Syria, people coming back in all kinds of ways. There is validity there, certainly, in some of the claims that he's making.
What about intervention of some sort? What about shaping things in Iraq?
That's something entirely different. And I think he's actually been slightly misinterpreted over the last few days. He wasn't calling for a full-scale military intervention or anything.
He actually said that. He said, I'm not talking about boots on the ground. Yeah. But it brings, for any discussion like this, it's a very difficult nettle to grasp, isn't it? Because the West has before intervened in the Middle East, and that's led to what we're seeing now. Sam, what's your opinion on this? Should there be military intervention from the West?
Well, another thing I've been calling out for since 2012 when I was there was military intervention, you know, to help to bolster the FSA, for example, in Syria. You know, the FSA was the People's Army, and look at it now, like, it's fallen apart, defectors left, right and centre, to ISIS. You have the People's Army defecting to ISIS. Why? Because for the past 2-3 years there's been an EU embargo which only really affected the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, which is the People's Army. So you had extreme groups like ISIS and Jabhat Nusra and other ones with their old methods of getting the weapons that they need and ammunition. And you had Bashar shipping in his from Iran. The only people who were being affected were the moderate Free Syrian Army.
So when you say you'd like to see military intervention from the West, from where exactly? The USA? The British? Where?
Well, no. First of all, I'd say NATO before any. That would be my choice. But as well, I'd like to see, like in Syria, you see, with Syria now pouring into Iraq, it's something unique and new that we haven't witnessed before. How do you intervene now? Do you intervene in Syria alone and not in Iraq? Do you intervene in Iraq and not in Syria? You know, are you taking on the people and ISIS? Is it just ISIS that are going to be eliminated? You know, how much collateral damage is going to be caught up in all this? You know, so to foresee what's going to happen, as I said, I would rather see diplomatic solutions, political solutions, Maliki being demanded to step down. He's already had two terms to step down, and just as a gesture alone to hold back some of this.
But Ali, a NATO force to stabilise the situation, what do you think?
No, I would say the United Nations should do something.
I didn't mean to actually NATO troops and strikes. Like what was done in Libya, surgical strikes that helped, you know.
Some would say there's very little surgical about those strikes.
Well, I've witnessed them now in Libya firsthand, to be honest, and I've seen one building level to the ground and the other on either side without a glass pane gone through. So if the strike
is... But we've had umpteen reports of civilians being killed in various locations where strikes have been used.
Well, that
depends. We were told as well that they were surgical strikes. But that as it may, I take your point. That's sure. what you'd prefer. Ali?
I would say the United Nations, if they take a decision, they just meet. And then if it's the United Nations, then it is something legal. But I would say that if any other body gets involved in that matter, it will only add fuel to the fire and it will increase hatred. It will not help peaceful coexistence at all.
What can the United Nations do?
Well, I would say, although the United Nations is not the absolute fair organization, however, still it represents something that does not belong to one country. You see, at least they have this capacity. You see, and if they impose sanctions, and if they place troops in Iraq, or they say, but definitely if they go to Iraq, they have to go to Syria. Say they have to tackle the two issues, and they can't have the double standard that Muslims in various parts of the world have been shouting against for ages and ages, and nobody hears them. There is a need actually for a revolution of fair basis. Something fair for everybody.
But if Vincent Jurak, if the UN were to try a political or a diplomatic solution in this crisis where there's so much vitriol and venom, is it doomed to failure?
Well, it depends on how it's constructed. I mean, it seems to me that the starting point here is that we are, as I said earlier, overly focused on ISIS, and I don't minimise the damage that an organisation like that can do, but 7,000 or whatever it is, fighters are not going to take control of Iraq. And we have to ask ourselves the question again, why it is that those parts of Iraq that have come under control of insurgents or popular mobilisation, why those parts of Iraq have come under the control of forces that are opposed to the Maliki government. And plainly and simply, this is about the internal disposition of power, of opportunity, and indeed of fairness, as Ali has said. And that is what has to be addressed, if at least we're going to talk about the situation internal to Iraq. Of course, there's spillover into Syria. It would be a very, very brave person who would be optimistic about the prospect of any international conference, intervention, diplomatic initiative that would take on both Iraq and Syria. It would be wonderful were it to happen. It is also something I think that would have to involve Iran. And if we're talking about elephants in the room, there's another one.
Sam?
Can I just say another aspect that makes this very unique is that America is now faced with turning. If ISIS is working now against Bashar on one side and Maliki on the other, one is a friend and one is a foe to America. Mm. And this is one body and of not just, as Vincent was saying, ISIS, but it's become more of a popular movement.
The enemy of my enemy is a friend, as I say. John?
But I think there is real potential here in the developing rapprochement between the Americans and the Iranians. So the Vienna talks, the nuclear talks, may well be the forum behind the scenes in which much of this will play out. There are lots of reasons, actually, for the Americans and the Iranians to think of themselves on the same side here. And a kind of tactical coalition, if you like, to tackle some of these issues. The Americans actually threw away a very, very good opportunity in similar circumstances after 9/11, when we had a reformist Iranian president, Khatami. The Iranians were very supportive of the Americans in Afghanistan at that time, and Bush simply threw away the opportunity to achieve a breakthrough here.
But
I get the sense that
there
is something different.
The US and Iran working hand in hand to shape some kind of a solution here, and if it's imposed, could burst open the Middle East, couldn't it? It could develop into a regional catastrophe.
It could equally go the other way. It could actually be the key to Syria and to all kinds of other difficulties. And we should understand, I think, that the talks that were going on in the autumn and actually seemed to have achieved a breakthrough at that time were very significant. If you listen to the mood music coming out of Tehran, and they have a very sophisticated social media apparatus now, there's been a notable change there. And it's there if you look at John Kerry's remarks over the last 24 hours as well in Washington. So I think there
were rebutted by the Pentagon.
They were, but qualified as well.
He said that there should be some kind of coordinated effort with Iran.
Sure.
And they recoiled from that, didn't they?
They did. But I've no doubt that this is going on in the background to the talks.
Okay, a number of your texts. Joe in Wexford says Iraq should be partitioned or a permanent power sharing system established. Its borders are old Ottoman Empire provincial borders. The Kurds also deserve a state, he says. And Paddy in Dublin says, you missed a point in what Blair said. It will not stop there. They will want, extremist Muslims will want to push further to the west, he says. Carol, what do you make of that point?
I don't know. Time will tell. As I said earlier, I think that, yes, extreme Islam is spreading through Europe and certainly in Britain. It's something I think that we don't really discuss. We seem to have this sort of very liberal, multicultural attitude of being afraid to offend people. And until we actually sit down and discuss this, you know, properly, it's going to continue. And we are going to be fearful. And we're not going to, you know, to trust each other's different communities. There's been reports that by 2048 in Ireland, the second biggest religion in Ireland will be Islam after Catholicism.
What's wrong with that?
Well, we've only just gotten the Catholicism pretty much out of the Republic's beds, if you could put it like that. I mean, it was the 1970s, even though that the Ireland was predominantly Catholic, 90-odd%, we voted to take Catholicism's special place as the religion of the majority out of our constitution, because we live in a republic, we live in a liberal democracy, we are the inheritors of Enlightenment values, and we really do treasure those. And that's why the Catholic Church's special status was taken out of our constitution. However, we don't want to see any other religious, as a secular country, other people's religious values being implemented into political life, into political laws.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that as a secular democracy, religion is a private matter. It does not impinge on the Republic's laws. It doesn't, you know, you can practice whatever you like in private and you can do whatever you like, but you do not try to impinge those laws. That's why we legalised homosexuality in the 90s. Well, we're slower than the rest of Europe when it came to all this, but we're getting there. We've legalised homosexuality and other, you know, human rights laws we have introduced that we have not depended on our religion to guide us in.
I think you're worried as well. You've written recently, mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong, of the influence of Islam on our laws, or you wrote specifically about Britain's laws and the Law Society.
Yes, well,
they're issuing guidelines.
And there are some areas in Britain and that where Sharia law now is accepted as law in certain areas. I would worry that in a liberal democracy, in a republic, that would be the case. I firmly believe that we have to defend our liberal laws. And basically, you have to, you know, we say toleration. Of course tolerate, but we have to be intolerant of the intolerant.
Ali, we need to defend our liberal laws against Sharia law.
Well, I totally disagree, of course, with that. You see, I personally think that everybody is entitled to an equal level of freedom that gives him the right to believe and practice whatever he chooses to do so. Mm. And I would say that this is 100% guaranteed by Sharia law. And if you look at the ancient churches, and the most ancient monastery lies in a Muslim country. See, and it has been protected by the followers of Muhammad over years and years until today's time. I have to say that comparing Ireland to Britain is not fair. See, for a number of reasons, you see, like the Muslim community has been in Ireland since the early 50s. And show me one incident, crime, recorded against Muslims. in Ireland. And this is not because Muslims are angels. This is because of a number of reasons. The Irish government has been working hard over their time to keep the Muslims as an integrated part of the Irish society. The Muslim leadership has been working very, very hard on that to keep Muslims an integrated part of the Irish society. The very important recipe is equality. You see, now, if you look at the history of immigration in Ireland and compare that to France or to Britain or even to America, you see, like America had the strongest system of security. If you compare the American system of security to the Irish system, we might need in Ireland 20 years to reach that level. However, Ireland enjoys a wonderful spirit of peace among all members of various communities residing in Ireland, and that is because there is equality in this country.
Can I ask you, Carol, about an article you wrote recently? And I'm not sure if this is from the Sunday Independent, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. Is this the title of it? We should take the threat of Islamism seriously. Maybe that's... but this is certainly a quotation. What about the rights of the individuals who live in Britain and elsewhere in Europe but are forced to abide by a legal system that actively discriminates against them, women and gay people, and against the law of the land?
Yes, that's what I would have. And I think you did say a few years ago, Ali, that if there was a majority of Muslims in Ireland, that you would hope that Sharia law would be introduced.
No, I said we live in a democratic country.
Yes.
And then if there, likewise, we have a referendum. If we have a referendum here to say that, okay, let's pray in this way for these people, why not?
Well, because I think that by doing that, you are conflating religion with political life. And I think political religion should be kept to the private sphere, and that Sharia law would be a part of religion. Also, in a democracy, we actually, first of all, we live in a republic. Therefore, we have a constitution. And that actually is even more important than the democratic aspect of it, because democracies are not always correct. They can vote for all sorts of different things, which may be inherently unjust.
Well, that's
and that's
fine.
Why we have a constitution.
Well, that's fine. You see, that's what I say. We vote for everything, you see. And if the vote goes for the right, then let's be all right. And if the vote goes to the left, then let's all accept the left.
Why would we vote on how we should pray?
Well, no, I'm just giving this as an example, you see. But what I'm saying is that, you see, if we live in a democratic country and if we really evaluate the democratic atmosphere that we are enjoying, then everything should be put on the table and everybody had the right to vote on that.
John?
The threat alleged, represented by militant Islam, is a chimera. It's non-existent in Ireland as elsewhere. In the United States, there have been virtually no deaths from Islamic-related terrorism since 9/11. Okay, there is a vast security structure that has sprung up to support this. So the Rumsfelds of this world, Dick Cheney and others, all of them with links to private companies, private security organizations that have benefited enormously from government and agencies that have been linked in one way or another to securitization. So that's part of the agenda.
So
are
you saying the likes of Carol, and I'm not singling you out because many other people are making the point, are latching on to statements from the likes of Tony Blair that if we don't shape what's happening in Iraq or the Middle East in some way, that they'll come and bite us back?
But is that not a different issue? I'm talking about, say, human rights abuses, like I would, you know, against homosexuals, same-sex parents, adulterers or whatever, you know, things like that. Private matters that I would consider that
Ali
should be more private.
Ali is sitting beside me right now and I don't feel threatened at all. At all.
Well, here you go. Here you go.
But Carol, are you conflating Islam and extremist fundamentalism?
Oh no, that's what I mean by that is would be Islamicism, of course. Islam, the vast majority of people who practice Islam do not practice these sort of things. You know, they would not push Sharia or anything like that on democracies.
If I may come in here, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I would say, you see, I definitely don't mean you, but I just feel that there is a little bit of misunderstanding when it comes to the term Sharia. Sharia means that everybody lives according to his values. Sharia means if I live in a Muslim country where the Islamic law, the Sharia, is implemented and the police meets the two of us, you and I, and you have a bottle of wine in your hand and I have a bottle of wine in my hand, the Sharia law tells them that they should take it from me and pour it because it is of no value in Islam. But they cannot come near you because you are not a Muslim, so they cannot impose Islamic regulations on you. That's what the Sharia says.
But if you could impose Islamic regulations.
No, the religion says no. The religion says no. The religion says, okay, you are not a Muslim. You live in a Muslim country and you want to drink alcohol. That's fine. You can do that, you see. You can hold a bottle of wine in your hand and walk. But if I, as a Muslim, walk in a Muslim country where they have Sharia law and I have a bottle of hand in my hand, then the Muslim authority have the right to take it of me.
Vincent Jura, can I bring you in here? Is there, and I'm not referring to anybody around this table, but is there an ignorance regarding cultural and sociological and religious understanding here that's feeding into the wider discussion and the debate on what's happening in the Middle East and in Iraq? And therefore, we don't challenge what the likes of Tony Blair says. We don't challenge the stance taken by the European Union or the USA or other institutions.
Yeah, I think there's some truth in that. I think there's a great deal of truth in that. And to some extent, it's necessarily so. I mean, we live in a confusing world. We live in a complex world, and we can't always affect to understand in all their complexity events that take place on a daily basis in that confusing world. But the reality is that there is a great deal of misunderstanding of the Middle East. There's a great deal of misunderstanding of Islam. There's a tendency to conflate idealized understandings and notions of Islam with the lived experience of hundreds of millions of people, which are very far from the implementation of Sharia one way or another. It should be added as well, of course, that there's absolutely no consensus on what is meant by Sharia. There's no consensus in terms of Sunni Islam, in terms of Shia Islam. There are different schools of law. There are different cultural, social and other practices. So when we talk about Sharia, in a sense, we're setting up a straw man. It can mean almost anything you want it to mean once you move beyond the text of the Quran, which itself is subject to such variable interpretation and has been for centuries. I'm never sure what people are talking about when they talk about Islam.
Once, John O'Brien, you understand what Sharia means, and once you understand what all the religious beliefs are and the various sects are and all of the power structures, you then need to understand the agendas being held by institutions and countries and so on. It's extremely complex, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't think there's no doubt, you overlay culture or different elements of culture on politics, then you add in local, national and international geopolitical tensions and rivalries, and it is enormously complex to understand. Just like, for people in Riyadh or in Baghdad, the politics of the European Union is rather difficult to disentangle.
Is that why then Western politicians make such a hame sometimes of their approach to the Middle East? Or is it simply a ham-fisted way of getting oil and increasing wealth?
No, I'm much more inclined to believe in the cock-up theory of history rather than conspiracy theories, actually. In the case of 2003, I don't believe that the Americans went to war for oil. I think it was a very misguided kind of global ideology centered on spreading democratic values, very misguidedly, with appalling results. So politicians sometimes actually go into these things for the right reasons, but they do so, from a canvas that's enormously lacking, that's really, really profoundly ignorant, as Vincent points out, on some of the more fundamental matters. We can see this in the memoirs of those actually very idealistic young Americans who went to Iraq to work for the administration after 2003. They very quickly found that anything they thought they knew about Iraq and about the Arab world was wrong.
Sam, we've talking about military intervention, we've talking about the crisis that's unfolding in Iraq, but at the moment there on the ground, we have an expanding humanitarian crisis, homelessness, displacement and hunger, and that's going to get worse, isn't that right?
Sure, yeah. If we're witnessing things unfold now in Iraq, of course the humanitarian crisis is going to grow exponentially, a lot further than already what we're witnessing from Syria alone. Like, 6 million or so displaced,
and that's often forgotten, isn't it?
The
debate very often centres on the political power struggle.
What I try to do now, in the position that I'm in with a lot of people from that maybe similar background, or with the idea of maybe going over to fight and stuff like that, is what I'm saying now is to try and push them towards humanitarian to help out in a humanitarian way, whether it be on the borders, whether it be because they're going, you know, a lot of people think that that you know that these networks and that all these guys, a lot of young men that what we're seeing is just young men with a conscience, and that's the bittersweet feeling I have about the Syrian conflict. Bitter in the sense that you have as young as 16-year-olds go from Ireland, go over to fill the boots of international armies and stuff, and sweet in the sense that at least somebody in this world still has a conscience.
Okay, we'll give Veronica in County Kerry the final word by text. That girl speaking is so right. All religion must be kept separate from the state. We have just about reached a point of being a republic, having gotten out from under the influence of the Roman Catholic Church. We must guard our secularism, she says. My thanks to all of our guests this evening, Dr. Ali Salim, Dr. Vincent Jurak, Hussam Najer, Dr. John O'Brennan and Carol Hunt Wimshe.
The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Kay Sheehy. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher is Richie Byrne. And sound supervision tonight was by Kieran Dunn.